Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before oil and coal project proposals started popping up in communities across the Pacific Northwest, plans to build liquid natural gas terminals were emerging along the coastline from Oregon to British Columbia. And now that nearly every proposed oil and coal terminal has been stopped in the region, LNG continues on. The battle over the Jordan Cove LNG terminal near Coos Bay has been going on for over a decade. Twice it appeared to be dead, only to be resuscitated last year by the Trump administration. Today we talk with Jody McCaffrey, Executive Director of Citizens Against LNG in Coos County, and Shirley Weathers, a consultant and researcher living in rural Jackson County, about the continuing struggle to stop this terminal and its affiliated Pacific Connector pipeline. Shirley, welcome to Locus Focus, and Jody, welcome back.
Yes, hello. Thanks for having us.
Yes. So just to let listeners know, Jody, you're talking to us from Coos County. Are you actually in Coos Bay or what little town around there?
I live in North Bend, which is basically right next to Coos Bay.
Right. And then Shirley, you're in rural Jackson County.
Right. Eagle Point.
Right.
Near Medford.
Right. So we've been talking here on KBOO about this proposed LNG terminal forever. And I know that Jody's been on this show a few times, and Chris Andre has been covering this story from basically the beginning. And Jody, for a while, it seemed like you were like one of Chris's co-anchors on the show. You'd be on so much. But it's a story that really, I think, has only started to gain traction here in Northern Oregon relatively recently. And there was a wonderful rally in Salem about 6 weeks ago to stop the Pacific Connector pipeline. And it drew people from all over the state. What would you say? I'd like to sort of start by talking a little bit about what you've been fighting over the last, what is it now, 12 years?
Well, their first application was in 2004, before actually the Energy Act. That next year, the Energy Act kicked in, and we had started all these processes, and they all went on hold. And so it's been, since that time, which is, 14 years of, I wasn't actively fighting it totally in the beginning. I mean, at first I didn't know what LNG was. I had no idea, but I was curious, and that's led to this. Once I educated myself, I was like, why would we want this? This is like a horrible idea, and it's in probably one of the worst siting locations of any of the proposals out there.
Well, one of the challenges, I think, has been in the struggle about fighting LNG and other, quote, natural gas projects, is that until recently, people thought that natural gas was a good thing. And back in 2004, fracking really hadn't come to the forefront in terms of at least people being aware of it. And I don't think it was nearly as common a practice as it is now. So when you first heard about the LNG terminal, did you think, oh, yes, natural gas, I heat my house with it, it's a fine thing?
Well, in 2003 and 2004, there had been a Coos County pipeline that was committed, it was finished. That came over from the Roseburg Lateral, and so most of the people here do not use natural gas. It was not available much. Most of what that pipeline is still underutilized. Only about 10% of the pipeline is used, and so the way they brought about this project in the beginning was, oh, they're going to use our pipeline. You know, they're going to pay us back for this pipeline that we should have never really built in the first place. And so it was hard to fight some of that. And then the next thing you knew in 2006, oh, no, they're not going to use our pipeline. They're building a whole another pipeline. So it's been, really hard to get people educated. And this is kind of a rural area. We're off the beaten path. And we don't have, a lot of larger environmental groups that have groups here. So in the beginning, it was difficult, and I think a lot of some of the environmental groups thought, well, natural gas is better than coal, and so they were thinking it was clean until the truth came out about fracked gas and all the horrible implications that has in the environment, and that also that methane's actually a far worse greenhouse gas than carbon, and so you're not gaining anything, and now people that have done studies realize that. this is not any better than coal. It's still fossil fuel. We need to get off of fossil fuels. We need to go to cleaner systems, and and cleaner systems are available. We could be doing this right now and creating thousands of jobs, but unfortunately, you have people that are still in this old mindset and a lot of money tied up in some of these fossil fuel dinosaur projects.
Well, it seems that you've gotten a lot of support in fighting this proposal, and particularly the pipeline, from people not just in Coos County, but people who live in the path of this proposed pipeline. So who are some of the people that would be affected, and what is the path that this pipeline would be taking?
Well, it's 232 miles, and it would go from Coos Bay through our estuary some way. At first, it was 2 miles up an inlet. They would dig a big, huge trench up this inlet. Now they've changed their mind. Oh, that's not a good idea. Now they're going to try to do a horizontal directional drill for like 2 miles or something, or actually I think it's more than that, under the estuary, which is, you know, this is unstable area here. And then it would go over the Coast Range through timberlands, through private rural farmers and homeowners and people that, you know, moved out in these rural areas. They're not highly populated, but they moved there for a reason, to have the quality of life. And, you know, they thought they were buying a piece of paradise, and then they realized, no, they're going to put this huge pipeline that if it were there was a accident or a leak or something, you know, there's no rural fire protection, are very limited in a lot of these areas. So, you know, you're kind of a sitting duck if you live where this pipeline's going through.
And also, there was a big question about how they were going to get the land. Wasn't there talk about eminent domain?
Yes, there's people have risen up. The landowners, my hat goes off to them, because these people have got educated. A lot of people that live in these rural areas don't even have computers. So you have to realize, one of my great heroes is this one landowner who is older. He doesn't have a computer, but yet he's come to hearings. He's helped me. We have to usually get a hold of each other by phone. But these people are not dumb. They're educated, and they've banded together and said, no, this is wrong. And it is so wrong at this point. It's hard to believe that we even have Americans that would, you know, in our Congress that would even think this was a good idea, or our president either. Because this is really about exporting Canadian gas, and they want to come and take American landowners' property away from them through eminent domain, because these people are not going to settle for the one-time measly payments that they are offering. It's totally a rigged system, and they're not going to settle for that. I mean, their property is worth more than they would ever get from this pipeline company.
Well, also, there's been a strong alliance with the tribes, and I wonder if you can talk about the impact that this would have on their waters, and why they have become such a strong voice, particularly young tribal members, in fighting the pipeline.
Well, the thing about that's interesting about this project is Jordan Cove is a cove near where this facility is going to be proposed, and it was named after Peter Jordan, who was a Coos Indian, and he lived out there, and that was their ancestral lands, where the tribes had actually part of their village was out in this area, and a lot of it we don't know, because they don't like people knowing where those areas were, because they don't want artifacts taken. And this goes through quite a few of the tribal. It's the Confederated Tribe of the Coos, Lorampua, and Siuslaw Indians to begin with. Then it goes through other tribal lands all the way, several, the Klamath Tribe. There's several others, I can't think of their name right now, but there's several tribes that are impacted. And they were kind of not real vocal at first, because, you got to realize, if you're vocal in Coos County, you're going to be really ridiculed. And there's some, you know, redneck type mentality here that just kind of is blatantly not nice to people who don't agree with them. And so, you know, it's been difficult for me to, you know, have your name slandered in the press and stuff, not by the press itself, but by people that have written things. I would go to public hearings and have to stand and hear how terrible I was, you know, by these people that were just basically uneducated. So what we've tried to do is educate the public. But I will tell you one thing. When we knew what they were doing because we've gone through about 40 known land use processes for this project. And from the very beginning, you could see how they were manipulating. They weren't doing what they said. They would, now they've gone in and tried to change the codes so their project work fits. Mm-hmm. And once that Dakota Access problem happened, and that tribal, they realized what these people will do, I think all the tribes woke up a lot. That has been such a boost for us because, you know, it's better to get involved before the permits are issued in the permitting process when you can get involved in the hearings than, like, afterwards because you see what they do. They don't care about your artifacts. They just plow through and get her done.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG FM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Jody McCaffrey, Executive Director of Citizens Against LNG in Coos County. And we're also about to hear from Shirley Weathers, a consultant and researcher living in rural Jackson County. And we're talking about the proposed Jordan Cove LNG terminal in Coos County, Oregon, as well as its allied Pacific Connector pipeline that would travel across a wide swath of land to get LNG to the terminal. I want to bring Shirley into the conversation now. Shirley, you live in basically kind of central Jackson County, from my imagining of it. And I'm wondering, are you and your neighbors also impacted by the pipeline, or do you have other concerns that have brought you into this struggle?
Well, where we live is roughly 8 miles south of where the pipeline will cross the Rogue River, or is proposed to cross the Rogue River and the Highway 62. So it's close, but not we're not impacted landowners per se. The reason that I've gotten involved in this is actually because before we moved here to Oregon in 2013, my husband and I lived in the Uinta Basin in Utah for 18 years, which is oil and gas country. And when we arrived here, lo and behold, the proposal was on the books for many, many years to take some of that natural gas that's coming out of the Uinta Basin and pump it to or push it through the pipe to Coos Bay and export it as liquefied natural gas. So it just sort of seemed logical to get involved.
Actually, it's kind of interesting to go from one end of the pipeline to the other.
Right.
What kind of expertise do you feel like you bring to Jackson County from having lived in Utah all that time and seen kind of be on the front lines of oil and gas extraction?
I've seen it firsthand. The area that we lived in, we moved there because it was beautiful and the air was clean and it was high desert. And over the time we lived there, the air in the area became worse and worse to the point where it was about to reach non-attainment status in terms of quality. And that was in part because of all of the activity that goes on around oil and gas development. And there was a major boom. It's a boom and bust area, but there was a major boom for many years while we were there. And it has a tremendous impact on health and so forth. It was interesting, though. My husband and I were informed by Bill Barrett Corporation in 2010 that they were going to drill an oil well on our property. We had 40 acres of primarily pasture land. And so that puts us in a very empathetic situation with landowners here. When you receive notice that this is going to happen to you, it comes as practically a done deal. And the only thing you can do is what Jody has described. You scramble to learn as much as you can, as quickly as you can, because they know everything. They have all the cards. And you're just by your onesies trying to learn how to fight the issue. As it turned out, they didn't drill on our land primarily because of a riparian area problem, but that was the expertise I brought to Oregon. Interestingly, here we're dealing with a pipeline and natural gas rather than an oil rig and oil drilling. So the regulations are different. The I have learned a whole lot since I moved here, just wanting to get involved, and I really sympathize with the landowners here who have had to go through this same thing.
Well, one of the things that really impresses me by everybody that I've talked with who is fighting fossil fuel development here in the Northwest is the amount of research that people have undertaken and the depth and length of documents that one pores over, and that the documents that get forwarded to me. I mean, Jody is a person who forwards these amazing documents, and I look at them and my eyes start to glaze over because they're hundreds of pages long. Well, actually, the one you just sent me, I think, is only 62 pages long, and they're written in legal form, and it's like, I'm just curious about that process you go through where you go from, I mean, what motivates you to go from looking at these documents, whether it's an environmental draft statement, impact statement, or whether it's other kinds of government forms or processes that are going through. What gets you from having your eyes glaze over to where you dig in and start to really read and to start to absorb what it's about?
Well, I find it. Are you talking to Shirley here?
I'll talk to both of you. But you, Jody, you've been sending them to me longer than anybody.
Yes, I think this last process, we're still in a land use process. Actually, I will tell you this: in November, the Land Use Board of Appeals actually remanded their land use permit back to Coos County, and we actually lost on a couple issues. We won on a lot of our issues, but we lost on a couple. Those issues we appealed to the Court of Appeals. We just had legal argument February 15th, and we will know, you know, probably in the next few months how that comes out. So these guys, you know, after all this time, they still don't have a land use permit. They have tried and tried and tried. And I think what's kept me at it is there's something in me that says if you have to cheat and do these, you know, do things underhanded to get a permit and not be above board, that just makes me so mad. You should, if your project is so good, you shouldn't have to do that to get a permit. But yet that's what the level they stoop to. And then I think the other thing for me is I have felt so, when you go into these hearings after you've done this several times, because, you know, we've gone through this whole process. This is the third time on the federal and state processes, and the land use has been, you know, continual because they keep realizing, oh, that's, we're changing our project now. So then they throw something else out there. And people come in, and they don't know these processes, and you feel for them because they got their shark attorneys coming in, you know, that know how to dance around and get through this, and it's so unfair, and particularly like in our area, because this project is going to negatively impact like our oysters. We have large oyster growers here. We have clammers, people that clam. We have crabbers and fishermen. These are not people that normally go in and know how to legally defend their business. So you got, it's not, their hands are tied behind their back, and I don't want to see our area, because I live here, I grew up here. We call this an adventure coast because it is. We have some awesome places here. There's over 3,000 and something jobs if you look at the statistics that are already here for travel and tourism industries. We have a Dunes National Recreation Area. These are all going to be negatively impacted. And so when they talk about this bringing jobs to the area, it's not that many jobs, and you're negatively impacting hundreds of jobs. So it, to me, what has kept me going, and it's frustrating because I feel like I'm writing the same things over and over and over again. This last process, I think my submittal was 1,000 pages, but it was nothing because the record was 13,000 pages. Most of that was stuff they submitted. You're supposed to read through that in 2 or 3 weeks and be able to comment on it. You can't possibly do that. So what you have to do is just know where they've had problems before and just go look in certain areas, and you can't catch everything that's wrong.
Well, one of the most mind-boggling things about the Jordan Cove project to me is how many times it's died and come back to life again. And I think the last time we talked actually was the last time that it was killed before Trump became president. So let's just go through a little bit of a history of the challenges that actually took it down and then how it's come back to life.
Well, it's kind of frustrating because I just looked and saw that, I don't know if I say their name right, Pembina. They bought this company or took over the company a few months back, and now they're investing money in this. And they act like, you know, that, oh, we just had this little problem and we'll fix it, and then we'll go on. This project has major problems. That's why it's never gotten federally approved. And even when you look at those federal processes, like the very first one, I think Western Environmental Law Center and the Sierra Club were working with us on that. We filed a request for rehearing along with a lot of citizens and landowners. That never got resolved. There's huge environmental issues going on here. There's issues with safety because they want to build this directly across from an airport runway. I mean, nobody in their right mind would put this facility where these people are wanting to put it. But yet, here we are. Like, if you go to listen to them in Canada, they paint this whole other story about this project than what reality is. So from the very beginning, it never would have made it past the environmental issues. And they knew that. So that just kind of died, and then they, oh, well, we're going to export now. You know, the very first project in 2006 that they filed with FERC was an import terminal. They were going to import energy because we didn't have enough and Canada was running out, et cetera, et cetera. Now we know all that was lies, you know. They weren't telling the truth. So then a few years later, after we had gone through all these processes and we had filed the FERC had tentatively approved it, but we had filed a request for a hearing. That was never really resolved, those issues. And then they filed their export application. And that one, I thought, oh, I got to do this all over again. We thought that would be easier because it was obvious exporting would not be in the public interest. Yet here we went through this whole process, and you know what? People stepped up, landowners stepped up, and FERC listened. They actually listened and denied that one.
I was going to say what FERC stands for.
Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
And wasn't this like a groundbreaking decision that FERC in the past is like just rubber stamped all kinds of proposals like this?
Yeah, FERC, rarely has FERC ever said no to anything. In fact, I was looking because rarely am I, you know, on the same side as the chemical manufacturing companies, but on this issue of LNG export, we're on the same side. And they wrote a letter just in February, the Industrial Energy Consumers of America, which is a lobby group for the manufacturing-based company, and they were saying that the Department of Energy is, you know, who also has to give approval for export. They've never denied a project, never. So for FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they do the environmental impact statements and all that process. They've always just said, oh, it's fine, you know, you can mitigate, do this. Well, so for them to say no was huge. And they didn't even get to the environmental part of this or the problems with it, the safety issues. And if you look at the environmental impact statements that FERC has put out on this project, the first two, they had, you know, over 100, I think it was like 114 conditions of approval. I can't remember what they were exactly, but there was over 100 conditions of approval, hard stuff. Stuff that they never would be able to meet, you know, a lot of that. But it looked like they approved it. Well, they really didn't, because they only approved it if they could meet those conditions. So FERC has never really said yes to this project, even the first round. But they clearly said, you know what, you guys don't have your act together. There's no market, and that's still true today. There's no market for this project. I don't understand our Congress. What's wrong with these people that they can't look at their gas industry statistics and see that these projects are not warranted? Why are they trying to export? They're trying to make it easier to export LNG. Why? Because what are they going to export? Build these terminals and let them sit there as dinosaurs or white elephants not being used? Because that's what's going to happen. And I think that's part of what I don't want to see them, you know, come in here, and the dredging they will do will be so negatively impacting to our oysters and clamming and our crabbing. And that's not going to recover very easily. And yet this project will be gone because you can see it's not viable. And my hat goes off to FERC for at least for once standing up and doing the right thing.
Actually, they did it twice, right? They turned down the project twice?
Well, they actually did because they denied the... Eventually, they, you know, they first one, they said, you know, you can't have that one either, you know, so.
So, and then after they denied, both times that FERC denied it, didn't the company, which was not Pembina, I forget the name of the company that was.
Verizon. It was
right.
Verizon.
And then they appealed the FERC decision?
Yes, they did. They asked for a request for rehearing. And I will say my hat goes off to the Sierra Club, I think, was one. Landowners, I filed a response to their answer. And basically FERC, you know, came back and said, we're not going to, you know, you're wrong. You did not. The problem with Jordan Cove is, like, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission or the DEQ or whoever will ask them for data, and they don't give them the data. They just give them all this stuff. They try to dance around the moon instead of actually saying, here's the data. Because if they gave them the truth, this project would have been gone a long time ago.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KPFG LPFM in Seattle. Today, we're talking with Jody McCaffrey, Executive Director of Citizens Against LNG in Coos County, and Shirley Weathers, a consultant and researcher living in rural Jackson County. And we're talking about the proposed Jordan Cove LNG terminal in Coos County that just seems to refuse to die. I wanted to bring Shirley back into the conversation to talk about this other thing that's been going on sort of more subterraneanly than LNG, and that's the coal bed methane extractions that I just learned about recently, and Shirley wrote a very interesting research paper about it last month. So Shirley, tell us about that, and does that have any relationship at all to the kind of way that the fossil fuel industry is eyeing Coos County in particular down in Southern Oregon?
Well, I would say this is definitely a fossil fuel company eyeing Coos County and hoping to make money off of fossil fuel extraction. It is not, from everything we've seen so far, related to the Jordan Cove project. Coal bed methane is what I'm hearing. And again, we're in the preliminary stages of learning about this. What I'm hearing is that the intent of this company is to market the gas, the natural gas that's extracted to the local area, and rather than to try to export it anywhere else. Jody mentioned the pipeline that was built in Coos County that is now not going to be involved with Jordan Cove, probably never was. That is the same pipeline that, as I understand it, would be used to provide gas from this project to local purchasers and users.
Now, is there actually a desire amongst people living in Southern Oregon to have access to natural gas for heating and, well, basically heating, I guess, and sometimes for cooling your refrigerator?
You know, I don't think I can answer that question. Since moving here, we have been really amazed at how really electric heating tends to be, at least in our area, what people are using. People have told us they're actually afraid of using natural gas. It's not used around here. Jody would have to say if they're looking for it around there. And I have not had an opportunity to talk to the spokesperson for the company to find out if indeed their intended 400 ultimate wells, that's their business plan, the end goal, if they intend that could be sufficiently marketed in the near area. So I really can't answer that question.
I know. I mean, my experience living in rural areas many, many years ago, but nobody had natural gas when I was living up on Mount Hood. And people would have propane tanks, and they'd use it for their hot water heater and their gas stove. And
right.
Either that or you had electricity. And the idea of putting in the infrastructure to get natural gas piped to residential places out in rural areas, it seems like it's unfeasible and probably really unsafe. So to me, it just strikes me as a really odd thing to try to bring we'll call it frack gas rather than the natural gas, to Coos County and to Jackson County, to people who probably don't have any desire to use it?
Well, and it is extremely expensive for the individual household user to get into this, you know, to make that kind of a transition from the kinds of fuel and power generation that you're talking about to natural gas. The hookup fees are generally out of sight for people to buy into it. The idea of the motivation behind this company is something that we're looking into the most closely, because it has these particular five. They're currently working on five wells that were drilled in about 2010, and were at that time adjudged to be not adequately producing. Perhaps if they get into some more sophisticated hydraulic fracturing or fracking, they might be able to stimulate these five wells and the rest of them that they may want to follow with. They may be able to get them to produce more than on the first go around. But this area has been looked at really since the mid 1950s. Most recently, though, the greatest activity started right after in the early 2000s. But it's kind of curious that this company from it's based in London, and as are all but one of its shareholders. It's hard to quite understand why they have hopes for this to come to fruition.
Now, I guess I imagine most of the listeners don't really have much of a sense of what coal bed methane extraction is. How, in your paper, you say it's not the same as fracking. So how is it different from fracking, and yet how does it have some of the same consequences that fracking has?
Well, it depends very much how you define the term fracking or hydraulic fracturing. Some of the sources that I used for that first piece pointed out that there's a real difference in how the coal bed methane is released from the coal, and some sources do say that it is not, as I said, not hydraulic fracturing per se, but I have since read other sources, including a fact sheet that was put out by Dog Ami in Oregon, fracking is defined as really pumping any water down in through any process, regardless of what kinds of chemicals it contains, to disrupt and fracture the substance below in order to release the gas. So I would say that it's debatable whether my contention in the first piece is not hydraulic fracturing, whether that was correct or not. Well, I think now I would say it's a different kind of hydraulic fracturing. I would say different substances are generally used. I would say that isn't necessarily going to remain that way. Now that regular fracking, shall we call it, such as in the Rocky Mountain states and elsewhere, that may very well be utilized in the next go around, if there is one by this company.
Well, a lot of what I think when we associate with the conventional fracking has to do also with horizontal drilling, and that seemed to me there wouldn't be any horizontal drilling in the coal bed methane extraction.
That is probably accurate. I've read some summaries of well developments in other major coal bed methane developments in this country, as well as in China and Australia. What it generally says is the the vertical pipe is perforated, and then substance is pressured out into the bed from the vertical pipeline. So I think you're correct. At least so far, I have not seen that horizontal fracturing that we see in diagrams that or YouTubes that show how fracking works.
But on the other hand, one of the things that seems to be similar, you use the term produced water as being the end result of putting in this water with all kinds of chemicals laced that is used to release the methane, and then it comes back up again as it does in fracking, and in both cases it's called produced water, and then the question is, what do you do with it?
Right, and then another piece of that, another technicality, a difference between shale fracking and if we want to call coal bed methane fracking, is that in shale fracking, water is forced down and the process goes from there, water and chemicals. With coal bed methane, what happens is some water and chemicals or substances may be forced down the hole and into the bed. And then when the bed is so disrupted, there's water in the coal bed itself, and so the produced water is really not so much what's forced down the hole necessarily, but most of the produced water is what is released by the fracking mechanism or method. And then as that goes up to the surface, the gas then follows that ancient water, they call it, up. And that's probably, well, I would say, depending on what they put into the fracking water that's forced down in the first place, to the chemicals put in there, those are many of them secret because of the 2005 Energy Act. So we don't know what those chemicals necessarily could be, but there is also bad stuff down in that water that's been sitting for eons in the coal bed itself. So that can include hydrocarbons such as benzene, toluene, ethyl benzene, heavy metals, arsenic, cadmium, lead, mercury. In this particular water, apparently there, on the tests from earlier days, there's copper, excessive amounts of copper, which is also dangerous. So the issue with produced water is there's a lot of it, and it may contain a lot of impurities and contamination, and that has to be processed and removed before a DEQ's permit will be complied with. We can't be putting all that stuff just straight out into the Davis Slough, which is where this project intends to put it.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We're talking this morning with Shirley Weathers, a consultant and researcher living in rural Jackson County, who we just heard from, and Jody McCaffrey, who's executive director of Citizens Against LNG in Coos County. Jody, I wanted to talk about now, in the last remaining part of the show, why the Jordan Cove project has reared its head again. And there's two different words that come to mind. One is Trump and the other one is Pembina. So I wanted to talk about the influence that each one of those forces had on bringing a project that seemed like it was really dead a year ago back to life.
Well, it's a mystery to me. And I think they think that Jordan Cove tried to sell this as being the only West Coast terminal that's in the works, but that's actually not true because Alaska has had some proposals. There's some down in Mexico on the Baja Peninsula. Actually, there's been a lot of proposals that never made it because they realized these projects, you know, you're talking, in the case of Jordan Cove, this is not like they already had an industrial facility built here. Where they want to put this is in a coastal shoreline. I mean, this is a bird habitat area. This is a shoreline area. This is not an industrial zoned area. So they sell it as being, you know, we've got to have this for jobs, jobs, jobs. And I think what's happened is when the fracking boom happened states like Colorado and Wyoming, they were out there fracking everybody's property, and they did so under their own state rules, because some of that isn't regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they have this excess now and no market. And they think, well, here's this pipeline, we'll build this pipeline, and if we can get to the West Coast, we'll have a market. And I think Veresen, who has huge gas reserves, they did the same thing. And Veresen, and previously Veresen, it was Fort Chicago, but under Veresen, Veresen bought up all these companies that were not doing so well, and one of them was a big gas processing company up in the Montney Basin, which is up in Canada. They have all this gas, no way to get it to the Pacific Coast, because Canada, the tribal people up there, have not allowed them to go through their tribal lands to get from the basins over to the ocean. So now they think they can come down, and us rubes in Oregon, you know, we'll just roll over and let them build a pipeline through our properties. But even if they got their pipeline and their facility, the market is flooded. There is way too much export potential out there and not enough import potential internationally. And more people building all the time. And there's reports that have come out that have clearly showed this, that the projects that were already under construction were going to be doing good to even make it. And none of the others that are just proposed would be, you know, in the works. So, international gas reports have clearly showed this. If you read them, I don't know. I don't understand Washington. What's wrong with those people? Are they not reading the actual reports, or are they just listening to lobbyists? Because it kind of sounds like they're listening to the gas industry lobbyists. And I don't know. I don't know why they think that this project, I think they've got so much money invested. I think at one time I read maybe $400 million or something. I don't remember the exact figure. But they just keep dumping more money because they think, I think they have a wrong idea of how viable this project is of making it. I think they're listening to people that are not being above board with them on how things are. But, well, you know, they know that they can outspend us. And for 14 years, we've been holding our own, but it does cost a lot to go up against them.
Well, it seems to me when Trump became president that he had a mission that was not based at all on anything that made financial, environmental, economic sense, to like just basically, well, undo everything that Obama did and undo every environmental advance that we'd made in the last 8 years. And so he focused on reinstating the Keystone XL pipeline, reinstating, making sure that DAPL was built across North Dakota. And then he started focusing on Jordan Cove, and Jordan Cove became the high priority LNG terminal on the West Coast. So I wonder how you see that you can stand up to that force. And then that's combined with Pembina buying out, buying the company and bringing, I guess, maybe more money and more viability to it. Does that seem like it's what's going on?
Well, they do, but I still don't think they have the resources to build this. It's a pipe dream, you know. They're hoping they can get some other person to help them. They have more resources than Veresen did. Veresen never had the money to build this. They never were going to be able to do it without somebody else stepping in. And I don't understand President Trump. I thought he was America first. If that's the case, why isn't he listening to his own manufacturing companies that have been writing him letters telling him that exports will harm them? He says he's all about American, bring manufacturing back. Well, in some cases, manufacturing is coming back because we have low natural gas prices. And in fact, if they start exporting, natural gas prices will go up. And it increases by 1 cent, the cost to U.S. consumers is like $300 million. I mean, the American manufacturing companies have been writing letter after letter saying, this is not good for us. You're risking thousands of jobs in the manufacturing sector. So I don't understand the administration at all. I think that he's surrounded himself by gas and oil people that want to not lose their investment, because people have invested. This money came from somewhere. Somebody invested in this, and they don't want to lose their investment, even though they're going to lose it, okay? If you're not paying attention, you're going to lose it. And everybody, I think I read a thing on a while back where they were saying, you know, everybody's trying to pass off and say, oh, whoever ends up with the project at the end loses the money, you know. So everybody's hoping it isn't going to be them. So they try to sell this. I mean, Veresen was doing this terribly selling this project based on not correct statements that were going out there. So people in Canada that are mostly invested in this, they didn't realize what a horrible project this was. They should have realized, because FERC never says no to anything. This has to be a pretty bad project before FERC would say no.
So what are the chances of stopping it here at the state level? I mean, Jeff Merkley's come out against it. At the rally, people were really trying to raise the ante, so Kate Brown will come out against all LNG projects and probably all frack gas projects in Oregon. Do you see that there's a possibility that there might be a political shift here in the state and that it can be stopped at the state level?
Well, there is processes. That's what's frustrating. There's federal processes, but a lot of those federal processes involve state processes under the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the Coastal Zone Management Act. Now, a lot of this land use is part of the Coastal Zone Management Act. You can't just go into a coastal zone and do whatever you want, even though they have been doing that. There's rules and regulations for that. So I think the state does have a role to play, and I think as we've seen in some of the cases in New York, the state under the current system can rise up and say, no, this doesn't fit our standards, or this is not in line with what our regulations say you can do. If you look at their mitigation project, it's just ridiculous. There's no way it mitigates all the damage. This pipeline will impact about 400 water bodies. A lot of those are salmon-bearing streams. This is a huge industry for us, the salmon fishing industry. And, you know, a lot of the people in that industry don't really realize what's coming down the pipe. That's why some of us that have been fighting this, we're trying to hold the line to protect their jobs. They don't even realize we're doing that. So I think the state does have a role to play. My concern is this. A lot of our agencies have been taken over by political appointees, and this is going on at the federal level. So you no longer have scientific minds running these agencies anymore like that should be the case. You have somebody that has no knowledge, basically, can be a high school educated person running an agency. That's not right. That's leading us where they're making decisions based on politics, has nothing based on the facts, and that's harmful. We're going to, you know, why do you think the National Environmental Policy Act became an act? Why did the Clean Air Act become an act? Because there was problems, and those acts were designed to protect us from that. That's for the public interest. That's not to have somebody come in and just appoint a bunch of political appointees over agencies and undermine all that. We're going to end up right back with problems that created those acts in the first place. We have got to rise up and change the system so that we have educated people in specialties like biologists and fish people that are making decisions, not somebody that's making it based on politics. I think it's a dangerous game that's being played here, and Americans have to rise up. People have to rise up and say, enough is enough. We're not going to have this system like this because it's harming us. It's not for our American public interest.
Well, for listeners who want to get involved, I have links on the Locust Focus website to Jody's group, Citizens Against LNG in Coos County, and you can find out more about the struggle there. And there's also a lot of local groups working to fight LNG, and then there's another battle up in Tacoma, which we'll be covering in a few weeks. So I want to thank you, Jody and Shirley, very much for joining us, and hope to have you back on sometime soon.
Thanks for having us. And thanks. Yes.
Sure. We've been talking today with Jody McCaffrey, Executive Director of Citizens Against LNG in Coos County, and Shirley Weathers, a consultant and researcher living in rural Jackson County. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KPFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Kevin Martin, President of Peace Action, about the Trump administration's nuclear posture review, which would put Dr. Strangelove back in charge of our nuclear weapons policy. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening. Time keeps on slipping.